come to our panel discussion, which is a part of a conference organized around the idea of the Reformation, 500th anniversary of the Reformation. It's my pleasure to introduce you Gisa Rürig. He's okay, this is not very simple to define. Who are you? An actor, an accomplished poet, a thinker, which is equally important for me. Welcome to Kolozsvár. We will try to discuss together about the movie, The Son of Saul, movie which has passed a glorious journey in the last 1 year or more than 1 year. You know everybody that Geza is playing the leading role. What I want to tell you that behind this big beard is hiding Geza Rürig. I checked his passport. Okay, because if you know only the picture of the movie, it could be a little bit confusing. We are theater makers, so we can make up a Geza Rürig, but not an authentic one. because there is just one authentic Geza here. We are very glad that you came to Cluj. In the discussion will participate Mihaela Ursa. She's a professor of comparative literature at our university, and István Berstan. He organized our conference, which is going on practically now and tomorrow too. You are warmly invited to participate to the conference. Also, we will speak at the conference in Hungarian language. Okay, just to make it clear. So Levente Molnár is on his way. Hopefully he's heading the university, so he will join us, but we decided to not to wait him. Levente Molnár plays also in this wonderful movie, which in my opinion has changed the discourse about cinematography, about the contemporary cinematography. We will talk about this issue also, I hope, which is, I think, especially interesting. So I will sit down now. I sit down like this. Okay? Let's begin our talk by asking Geza, can you recall your first visit to Transylvania or even to Cluj, to Kolozsvár? When it happened, what are your memories? And I know that you are very attached to this region. Why is that? We kept meeting from the beginning of the 90s, right? Okay, tell us something, because now you live in your city, after living Hungary like 1 decade ago or 15 years ago, I don't know. Sure, take a mic, please, and...
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming. It is true that I am deeply attached to Transylvania. I was in high school when I came here first, and I never came here with a specific goal in my mind. I just love being here. And often I spent whole summers in Transylvania, and I don't mean just because it's, you know, it's a huge territory, and I was all over. It was cheap. I was young. I had very few responsibilities. Had no family, and I didn't have to make money besides for myself. Life was cheap back then. Wasn't free, but was cheap. So during the Ceausescu years, I came here at least once or twice a year. I have friends here. What can I say? I miss the place. And whenever I'm in Hungary, I try my best to come. I regard Transylvania as a part of my home. I was in love with a woman from here. So it's just...
Who is that? Tell me, just to continue in that very personal level, do you write poetry in English too?
No. And I don't mean to, I don't plan to. It's not for ideological reasons, it just doesn't come to me that way. It's just as simple as that. I read a lot in English, but generally speaking, I don't read fiction. I read non-fiction mostly.
Okay, now we all know about you that your relationship with the film is an organic one, but finally you didn't end up doing movies. Tell us, please, for warming up our discussion, how you got in this movie, because you are playing the leading role. Is this your first movie you played as an actor, or what is the story of this success?
I don't consider myself an actor. I would call myself an accidental actor. It's just it came to that way that I'm 49 years old. I didn't plan to be in any movie, but in my early 20s I did play in two lead roles in two movies. One is a Hungarian movie and the other one is Polish. I speak Polish. I went to university in Warsaw. So besides Transylvania, I have another country, plus Israel. I have, different places in the world that I have very deep connections to. Interestingly, even though I have been living in the United States for 17 years, I didn't develop such relation to that country, which is a great country on its own way, but I personally don't feel myself very much home there. To answer your question, it really just a chain of events how Laszlo, the director of the movie, whom I met 6 years before the movie, and at the time he didn't have this movie in mind at all. And we didn't become friends, but we did spend a day together, and I thought that's that. And he thought that's that. We didn't change phone numbers or emails or anything. And then when he was running up for shooting his first feature movie, he lost his actor. The actor didn't die, God forbid, but sort of aged. It was a Georgian actor from the former Soviet Union, and they were about to sign a contract with him to play the role of Saul, and he looked more like someone in his 50s. And according to the script, Saul is in his 40s. And it was very strange. So much can happen with one face. And so since the last time they saw him, he aged for who knows what reasons. And he felt uncomfortable with his new look. And so there they had 3 months, and they were panically looking for somebody, and all they knew that this is not an ordinary role, it's not an ordinary challenge, so to speak, for an actor. So they were looking for a face that is not known and not, and for that reason cannot be associated with other roles, you know, in previous movies and so on. And someone suggested to Laszlo that how about Géza? And Laszlo recalled that we did meet once a couple of years ago. So he emailed me the script, but he did not tell me that he's looking for Saul. You know, he just said that
for the leading role, right?
Right. He did not tell me that. He said just you know, let's catch up. What's with you? And then because I represented a certain amount of risk, especially for the producers, they were not necessarily happy. They thought that. You know, I might not succeed. I'm not a professional. So we had to convince them, and we, with a video camera in a private apartment for days and days, we were trying to create some material for the producers to prove that you know, I'm the right guy.
Tell me, I don't want to stress this, but it just came to me that has he seen your face without beard before calling you and tempting you to be a part of this process? Because I think that this is important to talk about, because the whole movie, I assume that everybody have seen it, the whole movie, it's about the presence. It's about proximity, it's about the lack of images, it's about the imagination of the viewer, of the audience. And when you did these private recordings, how happened this?
Well, in general, I have a beard. And so it wasn't maybe this big, but I did have a beard when he asked me to come to Budapest, and I felt that the production and Laszlo himself is a very disciplined and serious person. I didn't feel like he's, you know, playing around with the idea. He seemed to be very committed with me, and so I shaved. Which brings me, that, you know, one of the things that all the prisoners told in Auschwitz and in other camps for the younger ones, the new ones, is that if you want to somehow advance your chance to survive, you do have to look good, you do have to look clean, because the Germans are very pedantic. And even though they are not giving you anything to shave with, but you don't see on the photos anybody with beard. So what they did, that they were looking for a piece of glasses, and the German, they called it schmutzig. If you were dirty, you get more beatings. And so one of the thing, and this was not just, of course, the beard, but your shoes and stuff like that. So, for example, for women, menstruation was a constant problem, because the women were just leaking all over and they were given nothing to. So this, the appearance, the look, that and your behavior, you know, there were several things that the old-timers were telling the new ones. To avoid conflict with the guards, is one way is to look good, the other way is to never look into their eyes, never talk to them, sort of be invisible, you know, just look downwards. And the reason I'm telling you this, because these sort of studies were very important for my playing, my acting. I you know, there's so many movies when inadequate behavior can be seen on on the movies. Anybody who read enough or spoke with survivors know that this is just so anachronistic. This is not how people talked and behaved. This is not how it was. So one of our goals was exactly that, to make it right this time.
Thank you for sharing this. I never asked you about this very interesting aspect of the face. And still, as you can see, I'm trying desperate to buy time because Levente Molnár is coming. It's like the Messiah of the panel discussion, and I hope he will get in and we can jump in talking more specific about movie. So, but now let's go further. I'm a little bit afraid to give the floor to the theorists because, you know, it's the best way to ruin everything. no, excuse me. Okay, fine. what we are saying, okay, I'm just provoking you. Okay, Mihaela, would you take a mic and continue with your question or
yes,
provocation,
thank you.
Our discussion.
I think you're perfectly right that when theorists come in, everything is ruined. But I'm not here as a theorist, even if I play one from time to time. I'm here as a viewer, as a film goer, as a reader maybe. And this is the angle from which I want to pose my questions and maybe to make my remarks. I'm thinking that there are a lot of people who, like me, I have to confess this, sometimes avoid watching films about the Holocaust, sometimes avoid reading fiction about the Holocaust because it's too much pain, it's too much atrocity, and it's somehow impossible to go back to being a human and to living a normal life, knowing that your humankind was capable of that, of creating all that pain and all that atrocity. And also there are actors who say that playing parts in this type of films is very life-changing. And you spoke a little about how a chain of events led you to this, and about how the film required a lot of study and a lot of altering what we would think as modern people who didn't have to go through this, as we would think that the whole thing went on. And I had this thought in mind when I watched one of your interviews where the interviewer was asking how hard was it to play this part. And I very much liked the answer that you gave. You said it wasn't as hard playing it as it was rehearsing for it, because the hardest part was the rehearsal, was the constant staying by myself, learning the lines, learning the part, being alone with what was going on in my head and with what was going on in the script. And then when playing it, it was somehow easier because there were other people on the set, there were cameras, there were lights, there was makeup and costumes, and all these sort of sheltered you from what's so hard to experience. And I would like you to comment some more on this, on how does such a part affect your life as an actor? Do you finish up this such a part and go back to being who you were before it, knowing a little bit more, having a little something more in your readings, or is it literally a new life that you have to begin after that?
That's a lot of questions, Michael. let's unpack it. Honestly, I will answer your question, of course, happily, but I don't... Oh, here is Levente.
Thank you, sorry, I am just a rude volcanic people, and because of the traffic I have to apologize, please excuse me, okay? And let me welcome with bread and salt Mr. Gates.
So, I'll briefly address the question you asked about how did it change my life, if at all, but more than talking about myself, I love to talk about the issue, the matter, and the question that you were asking about the preparation. So the preparation was, of course, hard. I didn't want the production to let down. This is an extremely low-budget movie. I mean, just in that year in Hungary, there were movies done for 10 or 20 times more money than ours. And we asked for 40 days of shooting, and we got 28. And Laszlo was in his mid-30s. This is his first movie. Everybody wanted to talk him off about the subject. They said, look, if you're going to ruin this, if you're going to... that this is a subject matter that maybe you should establish your name and do it this later, because as an entry point, so to speak, for a career, this is a very risky choice. We asked money from Germany, we asked money from Israel, we asked money from France, and the answer was that we are not comfortable to give you money because you don't know who you are, you have no movies done yet, and you are getting into yourself into a subject matter that is risky. Generally, the rule is that if you make a Holocaust movie, you stay away, you shy away from the gas chambers, you don't go near to the crematoria. Those are taboo, unrepresentable. So, you know, and it took a lot of courage of him to do this. And of course, when I signed up and I agreed this role, I believed in the movie. I thought the script is great. There was no need for another Holocaust movie of the sort that are there is 1,000 already. And to these movies, to my mind, didn't do justice with their subject matter. They were too light. They were too melodramatic. They were too emotional. And in those camps, in general, in the middle of a genocide anywhere, and within the group of the Sonderkommando, for sure, emotions were not welcome, because this role was unmaintainable, and nobody could live a life like that day by day if you kept your nerves and feelings and thoughts alive. So, to answer your question, I was extremely nervous and had all sorts of nightmares and panic attacks and all that on the way running up to the shooting. But surprisingly, the hardest part of this experience wasn't the preparation, wasn't the shooting, but was after the shooting was done, which came as a surprise to myself, because I had to lose weight, and the stake was very, very high, and I thought, you know, once the shooting is over, I'll go back to my regular life, things will be okay, I'll see my family, I can even have desserts and stuff like that. And to my own shockingly, it didn't go that way. The transition from the world of the movie back to my weekdays, my normal routine, was not really happening. I was already with my family, and food yet did not have taste. And what I recognized and that is that I some weird pervert way I had to confess that I'm missing the place. I miss Auschwitz, and I asked myself, what do I miss about a hellhole like that? What is the part? What can justify this feeling? And after much thinking, I came to the conclusion that in one sense and one sense only, Auschwitz was a place of truth. This place, these extermination camps, should have never existed, of course. But once they did, they offered one thing that you couldn't and I cannot find anywhere else. And that is that in this life, before Auschwitz, after Auschwitz, your look, your money, your last name, your connections, all these external and accidental factors either launch you on a great career, you get better jobs just because you are the nephew of that person, or you get better relationships because you are not short if you are a man, or you are not too tall if you are a woman. All these unfair things that someone has a good skin and someone has a less good skin and all that, none of these things mattered in a camp like that. It was only the character, what you were made of, you know, just your, you know, who you are. That's the only thing mattered. So in that sense, I found this life out here, the one I'm living, much more illusory or false or lying even, because I missed that, so to speak, interestingly.
Yeah. It's very hard to continue after this very touching confession, but let me ask you, I never name you Levente or Levente Molnár. Your name is Kecske. So we are colleagues and we worked together many times. Tell us your story. How you got in this movie and what happened with you during this process, and how do you feel now? How you watch back to this experience? Has it changed you, or tell us something about this whole story?
Well, I will start every sentence of mine saying I'm pretty much honestly sorry that I was late. And now that I have the mic too, sorry guys, okay, up there too. I'm quite impressed about your presence here and respect. Don't lose it. Trying to answer your question, where it goes somehow like this side of my, if I have a personality, and that it's definitely defined by the activities I'm doing. And you know me way much better than I know myself on this behalf. So many answers are in your pocket in here. Share just some, please. But I don't want to, it was like three parts at least in your question. What was before? Before was all right. What was in between? In between was all right. What is after? It's all right again. I don't need big change in my life. I'm not tracking in any lunar beam. I don't need I don't need anything more than work experience, work experiences, and I can live with them. This one was a hell of a good work experience. With all the tricky sides involved and everything, and I just catch some phrases from Giza about the preparation was quite interesting. It's exactly how an actor is, I don't know, an actor functioning like me would like to have a preparation period. It was spotless. When you feel that you got the chance, you're lucky enough to meet some people really involved in what they are doing, then the working process itself was quite focused and intense, and which is good again. It's good to go home tired because you've been working. Yeah? And then afterward, it was a lot of glitter and fluff and all kind of. I have to confess again, I'm much more interested in working in even students' projects than to participate in, I don't know what kind of side. But it is an industry, even in our place. And if I start to judge these events when we got lucky enough to participate, that means that I'm judging this moment right here, right now, when we are all together participating. And that would be a lie. So thank you again for the opportunity. That's all what I can.
let me continue asking you, or maybe both of you, about an aspect of this movie, the story of the movie, and the way it is constructed. Because I think that the movie is, I don't want to speak about success, whatever, blah, 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 because it's much beyond the importance of this event. It's much beyond success. You play a very interesting friendship, right? In the movie, you keep challenging him and in the same time helping him. You are an obstacle and at the same time a friend, or at least you develop a very special solidarity toward this totally absurd project of Soul to bury a child. We even don't know if the boy belongs to you or not. The movie keeps it in this fog, I think. How did you work together now? Because you are here together. This is a great chance to put this question. I mean the workshops before beginning the specific filming, how it worked, what way you got closer to each other, if it happened, I don't know. Okay.
Well, we did the practice. Laszlo brought it together. Us a couple times, and we spent, I think, whole days, a couple of few full days practicing. Because, I mean, the main relationship in the movie, obviously, is between Saul and the child. That beats everything. That's their bound is the one that, you know, by far is on the level of obsession or even mania. That you know, rules. That's the main, focus of the movie. And the number two relationship, and I don't think there is much like a number three even, the only other relationship in the movie Saul has is Abraham. And it seems from the script that they did, that their friendship goes back a way long, you know, before even got to the camp. They probably came from the same city or something. And I also know from Laszlo that that in the earlier versions of the script, there was a little bit more information, both about Abraham and both about Saul and, you know. And then Laszlo, and I think rightfully so, felt that it's unnecessary. It's unnecessary to flesh it out. It's unnecessary to go into details. And it's unnecessary for the viewer to know who is who. What was Abraham? Who was Abraham before the war, and who was Saul before the war, and what were they to each other before the war? Or, for example, the only lady in the movie, like Ella, who has, I think, like 28 seconds in the movie, and that's all she got. People oftentimes ask me after screenings, you know, were they lovers? What's the relationship? And it's also left intentionally enigmatic, because Laszlo realized that these people, the Sonderkommando members, have no past. The past doesn't matter. It's melt. It's gone. And they have no future. And so all they have is minute by minute the reality, just really to make sure that, you know, you make it. So I can tell you as an experience that, you know, we are very different, Levente and I. And I think when we had some sort of our differences, I won't call it conflicts because we never had any serious conflicts, but we are different. We are different by nature, we are different by whatever. And I knew that Laszlo is smiling because that was, I think, for the benefit of the movie. Because in the movie, again, they are whirled apart from each other. Abraham wants to participate and prepare the revolt, and that's all he cares about. And he thinks that I am a lunatic, an absolute crazy person, a stupid person even, an unusable person, because instead of doing what only makes sense is to get out from here and to kill as many of them as possible, I am very impractically and fully immersed in this, again, you know, crazy plan. And I even endanger this idea of revolting because I'm hiding a body and all that. So, yeah, that's about it. And you know, yeah, unfortunately.
It's so good to have the chance to hear, because at one point Geza went into the how the characters go, but it was the first encounter with Geza was the day when we spent it, the first day when we met. I thought I would beat the shit out of him because he was just like a carrot there already and trying to play with the fridge, basically, to squeeze some reactions out from him. We have this word in theater that instead of working with you, I would rather rehearse with the fridge because it reacts more. And I had this issue. Why is this guy so numb, basically? What's going on with him? And he was pissing me off, actually, quite a lot. And it was my first encounter with a man who was already in the character. I was the rookie. I was the cucumber, being unable to understand what the hell is going on. So in the same time as we are two completely different, we are gifted with two completely different personalities. I can fully agree on that one. But in a weird way, we have a lot more in common than we think, because exactly that goal. And I would argue because it was so nice to hear how Geza sees another character with what your character had to interact. Actually, Avram never had the idea of killing as much of them as he can. instead, it was because, and that you are just one, I am just one, and we had several different possible solutions, basically. He had his blocking on the child. I had my blocking on the revolt. The other one had his craziness about the picture. The other one had, and based on true stories. So basically, these characters, each of them are somehow beyond the state of being a human person, not allowed to be a human person, but still preserving that one nerve, that one thought that keeps them alive. A child, a revolt, a picture, a news spread, a something, each of these possibilities. And our movie, this movie, goes mainly on the on one possibility, follows Giza's possibility with the child, if that's an egoistic one, sacrificing everything around, or is really soul-saving and the only solution. It's just a question, not an answer to any.
I admit easily that my opinion about this friendship might have been a little bit too sentimentalist or too nice.
You're talking characters, or you're talking?
I'm talking about the story. I'm talking about the relationship with the characters. I'm talking about the possibility of breaking the rule of the camp. You know, because this is the idea here. This is the idea around the secret. What is the secret? You know, we worked together on Imre Kertész's Kaddish for a Child Not Born. The idea is to break the rule of the camp, because if you break the rule of the camp, everything is going to move, to be shaken, to go to an apocalyptic direction. But the apocalyptic direction here for me means something good, because destroys the essentially untrue, the created bloody reality. So that's why I think that I don't mean to be sentimentalist, but there's a question here which keeps challenging me regarding the movie. But now let's go a little bit further to read the movie, and the next theorist is István, who organized this whole panel discussion. And thank you very much.
I will continue, and I try to put a very concrete question to both of our friends. Okay, in the middle of the film, somewhere, Avram says to Saul, "You have abandoned the living fellows for the sake of the dead ones." And I felt that in this affirmation, there is a secret question within it. Why? How it could be possible? Okay, we could suggest several possible answers, like it's a compensation in a situation in which Saul is unable to change the terrible conditions and he has to do something. Or is it a rebellion of the normal against brutality? Or this stubborn will to bury the child is a symptom of madness, because it is so impossible in those circumstances. But I will try two other possible answers, and I'm very curious about your opinion about it. Could Saul answer to Abraham that, yes, I abandoned living fellows for the dead ones because the latter exceed the number.
Say it again at the end, I'm sorry.
They are too many people, dead ones, much more than living ones. Or, yes, I abandoned the mission for living fellow prisoners because, or in, for the sake of a dead body, but he, my son, died twice. Could be possible answers.
So, you know, Laszlo, the film's director, in my presence, we have been all around, I think, like 20 countries, and we answered every possible questions on earth regarding this movie. And he has much, he has somewhat less patience than I am for question hearing the, you know, so many times. And he used to say is that a piece of art is not like a crossword puzzle where, you know, there's a, let's say, a horizontal five, a river in Italy, two letters. Well, there's only one river in Italy that has two letters. It's called Po, so it's going to be P-O, right? So when it comes to a movie or literature, and you know this more than any one of us, András, István, and Michaela, it has layers. It's so complex that you have your own reading and I have my own reading. So right now, I'm going to tell you just my own reading. And that has a lot to do with your second suggestion, is that the boy died twice. I don't think that Saul, the conclusion was ever a decision on Saul's part. He wasn't making a thought process, looking at the pros and the cons. Should I hide the body of this teenager? Is it a good idea because of? This is a bad idea because of? No, it was instinctual. I think what happened is that this boy, by surviving the gas chamber, he clearly did something that he don't supposed to do. And even though Saul wasn't a religiously trained or educated man, because he didn't know what the Kaddish, right? Even for him, this was so challenging that you can call it God, you can call it destiny, but here is someone who is saved from death just to be murdered 2 minutes later. What's the point? Why are you saving him for the first place if right now these doctors are going to suffocate him to death? This was a out of normal thing. Even though death was all over, death enveloped everything, and you could say that they were so desensitized that death didn't make any effect on them. But this was an unusual way of dying twice. And the way I imagine my character is, and this was a moment that is unshowable in the movie, is that I think that they locked eyes. They looked at each other. They looked at each other. And I think it has a tremendous power when someone who you never met, because he wasn't his son, that's for sure, someone who never met, just before dying, during dying, is looking at another person. That's like adopting. He became his son. Because he was looking, what a personal moment, someone dying. I mean, we have no recollection of being born, but when someone is dying, the conscious is leaving gradually. You are sort of there, and then you're a little bit less there, and then at the end you are not there. And you look someone who's looking back at you, and the two souls, these two creatures, this they become attached. He became his soul, and he became his son.
This looking comes back at the end.
Yeah, it comes back at the end. So in other words, Avram didn't see the boy dying. Avram didn't have, because you can just look one person at a time. You can't look two people, right? So I think it wasn't, again, something that Saul decided to do. His heart empathized with the boy. He had a feeling he was back to human again. And the only way to be human again was to have this son. I came up with this analogy actually a couple of days ago. You know, when you have a little child and the first day you bring the child to the kindergarten. And then there's something called, I don't know how they, in English I think calls it the safety blanket. So the teachers in the kindergarten say, this is not allowed later on, but the first week in the kindergarten they allow the children to bring one toy from home. And they hold to that toy like it's, and they walk around and this is their toy. Right. And that was the child's body for Saul. He was, in a very scary word, he was already dead. Now he was resurrected. And this resurrected state was somehow depending on his ongoing relationship with the child's body. It wasn't enough to remember the child. It was to holding on to this child. This is absolutely irrational. I don't try to sell this as some sort of a human behavior that makes sense or anything. This doesn't make sense. But the surviving instinct to be human is such that the power of it, that he had no choice. It was instinctual. So that's why when Avram asks, it's a very rightful and legitimate question. Why are you abandoning the living for the dead? But there was no answer to that question. It's like the same question if you push somebody under the water and it comes up to breathe. And then you say, why are you coming up to breathe? It makes no... You understand that? That's why this was so existential for Saul that it was beyond ethics. He didn't do it for saintlyhood. He didn't do it to be ethical. It was his way of, only way of being alive.
I think this is the point that there were no... yes, you should. I just want to highlight this. In the case of Saul, but also in the case of Abraham,
yes,
and there were no ethical choices involved, like the breathing.
We'll debate on that one too.
Let's
interesting.
Try to do
it. Quite, don't forget your question, but let me answer yours first again, because it's and from the side of the practical Kabbalah, this line of you betrayed the living for the dead. We were completely aware that it's such a melted sugar line. We worked with Laszlo a lot how to actually say this line without being, you know, highlighted like, this is the message. We stamp you now. That's you. You have a yellow star on you, David. Thingy on you, and then we'll stamp you with this line, and you'll have to run away because it's quite from the actor's point of view and director's point of view, and how to. I'm sorry, I don't want to hurt feelings. We are talking about the movie, okay? We can go philosophical, we can go wherever, talk whatever, but still, it has a practical side, okay? How to say that line? Not to be too much, not to be too usually less is more. we know already, but how not to warm it up too much, not to cool it down too much. Don't punch it in the audience brain. And this specific line was one we were struggling with. Actually, that's why it's a good question, and we reached that moment at one point that this question, of course, it has no answer. It's up to the people watching the movie to find your... By the way, we can go smart as much as we would like to, but those of you who've seen the movie, you have all the answers, basically, because a lot of turning points in this movie are not asking for our answers at all. It's left to your decision, your soul, I think, basically, to answer. So, but, and this was from the practical side of making a movie, how to sell a line, how to hide it, how to put it. And then from the ideological, philosophical, or whatever, the importance, what a word, of this line, of the words you are saying, you know. It can be true. It's one of the possibilities that what he's doing, sure, is exactly that. There, every question we might ask today, here, or later on, it's going like, it needs your judgment in it. Was he doing that? Or can I agree or can I disagree? That's why I'm again apologize for being late and again apologizing for not having the one truth answer to any of your questions, guys, over here. I'm sorry.
So let's talk about the movie, about the practicality of the birth of the movie. You know, both of you participated to this process of filming, and when you saw for the first time the edited final version of the movie, did you miss footage? You know, everybody after filming remains with memories, even with this feeling that I was the best in that particular scene.
And whatever. They cut it out.
And they cut it out. Like
Laszlo did not much like me to see, you know, in the camera. When you're filming a movie, and even if you're filming it, of course, for 35 millimeters, there is a video camera attached to the big camera, so people right away are able to see what they were filming, because it's a very expensive thing, and you want to know if you captured it, what you wanted to capture. And there were very few times when actually Laszlo asked me to see. So I didn't have a serious... this wasn't my topic, so to speak, to say like, oh, I was better in this or that. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
And Laszlo was very economical. We had very little money. And just to tell you maybe one more like sort of a professional secret, even though I'm sure some of you have noticed this, that generally speaking, a full-length movie has somewhere between 200 to 300 cuts. And our movie has like 70-some. So that means that the scenes are long. And there were tremendous, I think really the burden on Laszlo and the cinematographer, Matyash. I'm not sure if I recognized this at the time, but you know, we had to do like three scenes, four scenes a day. And sometimes it went for a half a minute to a minute and a half. Now, a minute and a half without a cut in a movie, that's an eternity. That's so much. A minute and a half, lots of things happen in the background with the extras. There were lots of moving objects. Everything had to be right. Everything had to be choreographical, arriving on the time, leaving on the time, and all that. There was a certain element of chaos. You know, this was very important for Laszlo, that there's this notion, which is of course true, that there is a German way of being methodical, being very precise and all that. that when it came to the camp, there was a huge element of chaos. So, for example, not only the Sonderkommando members, but the guards too were all the time drunk. There was no other way doing it. I mean, 10,000 people gassed and burned a day. I mean, we are talking about the Hungarian deportation, October 1944. This is the peak time of everything. Full capacity, day and night. And once you are drunk and you have these unrealizable goals and you have the pressure, and even the Nazis were like sending telegrams, they stop sending people to us. And they were like, well, burn them in the pits. And so if we burn them to the pits, then the we can be bombed because the fire can be seen from above, right? So it was chaos and order. And the element of chaos was, I think, realized by the handheld camera and the way the picture was always, you know, moving, certain things happened. And so all in all, I just, what I, you know, wanted to say that. Yeah, so the element of chaos, what we really were after is not to tell you anything new. We didn't want to explain, we didn't want to have a new interpretation of what the Holocaust was. We have really no, like, new thoughts here. Basically, what we wanted to do is to take you there. It's one day of one man, just to take you there. And what Levente said is so true, that Laszlo was actually very conflicted about even to have that sentence in this movie. Because we thought that we never wanted to be didactic, we never wanted to moralize. And so this is a way of living the norm of the movie. Everything is broken, everything is visceral, immersive, and then here, There is this sentence which is like from a sermon, which is like a preaching sentence, and it didn't belong there. And there's a lot of back and forth by the time they, Laszlo and Levente, figured out how can this be said, this one sentence, in such a flat way, you know, less is more, without putting a lot much emphasis on it, you know, that it's actually not gonna sort of ruin or violate our decided goals.
Kecske?
Oh,
don't forget the question about the footage left out.
About the footage left out.
You have such a memory?
I have such memories of... I don't know. I'm, again, functioning wrong in a way that I don't really like to watch myself on set. When they are these, you have the possibility to watch yourself. Okay, we shot it, and now come and see yourself. Somehow, in a strange, I have to admit it, it blocks me, because it's with the final product. I remember when I see the final product too. Of course, I hate my voice, I hate my face, I hate how I move my finger. I'm the most. I mean, I'm criticizing myself a lot, and so if during the filming I'm blocking myself in this way, then after a week I'm just like a cactus, and that's one of the reasons why I don't do this. But there are many other people doing it, and I go and check it out, because we had the moments when I checked it, because as Geza was mentioning, long shots, 1.5 minutes. Huge choreography. You have to think. And actually, I think the most we did the scene like 3 times, and that was it. There was no 27 or something like. We were going on film, and that gives a completely different attitude, and brings in a completely different attitude from the whole crew. Because we are talking now here, one beautiful and great actor, one cucumber, but this camera has 360, a lot of people involved around it. I don't want to explain. I'm quite sure you all know, but they are unseen, invisible. But to start to shoot a scene, it means, like in our case, it was like 80 people to be ready, at least. To be in one specific moment ready for an action, which going to take 1.5 minutes, involves going from level 1 to level 2, 20 people from there, one explosion there, one something there, one, and synchronizing this, it is just a beautiful task. And the director, the most what he can do after choosing the right person in his team, than to rely on them and to give basically trust. And Laszlo was exactly this guy, being able to coordinate another chaos, by the way, you know, because you're feeling chaos, being influenced by chaos in the middle of a chaos. So it's at least triple chaos. And the first time I saw, I went to check in the moment, the shooting, the scene, when it was about fine-tuning. You go one bit, you start your step one bit, you look, you too much, less, get it back a bit, and two or three times I was watching it, but otherwise blocked it. And I managed to see for the first time the movie in Cannes. We were together on that crazy evening or afternoon, late afternoon, dressed like, feeling like, and then there we go. I don't know how was the first meeting, because we were just holding hands with Urs and getting, oh Jesus, oh look at that guy, oh my God, that's you over there. You know, not that you over there. It was, yeah, so I have no opinion about the first encounter with this movie.
But I remember that I sent to you a text message in Cannes, telling you that I am praying for the success of the film. And indeed, you answered me that, oh, the success is not important.
It is.
The birth of the film is
much
more important. And I was really, really impressed, because the text message came from Cannes. And that was nice. Mihaela?
I was going to ask something the previous question, so a moment ago. So I would like to go back to that. I want to ask our guests if they thought about how does this film compare to the other films made on the Holocaust. And to focus a bit my question, I want to say that to me, I think its strength is that the melodrama is absent from the movie, and there is no melodrama, and there is no heroic intention to oppose evil. The way I see it, Saul is, of course, kind of already dead inside, all closed in. He doesn't have any expectations and any intentions. He refuses to revolt. And other people may become heroes around him because other people want to revolt, other people want to fight back. But the only thing that he wants is to restore some kind of breath back into his life, and to go back to being to the most useless normality imaginable. And I think this going back to normality is what makes the film special among other Holocaust films. But I would very much want to know what you think about this.
By and large, and I'm trying to be very moderate when I say, because I got myself in trouble in Los Angeles being sort of not respectful enough of the industry, but by and large, I think that Hollywood in particular did use and abuse the Holocaust, exploited even, I would say, the Holocaust for its dramatic value, I think that there's a whole list of mediocre, untalented filmmakers who run a love story or just a absolutely cookie cutter, one of the dozens, you know, idea they have, and they think, you know, why don't you sprinkle a couple swastikas on it, and why won't you have this little Romeo and Julia C-rated, you know, whatever, watered up version of, why won't we surround them with a barbed wire, and it's like, you know, it's the last result of people who have nothing to say, and they use the Holocaust or any, you know, other terrible historical events as a background, instead of treating the matter and interrogate the matter. They are using it as decoration, and I think that's just not what you do with such events. And so I stopped watching these movies. They frustrated me very much. And to be honest, when I got Laszlo's email first time before I read the script, I would have said with all probability, I don't want to be part of this, because again, this has been done so many times, and it's never to my liking. And I think what was, if there is a secret, you know, why, what's the, instead of this formulaic way of doing things, the as business as usual, here is a Holocaust movie, here you go. What Laszlo realized is that the enormity of what happened, in terms of brutality, bestiality, the whole thing, you don't have to educate the people. You know, 70 years after, people, at least the ones that want to see the movie, right? They know what happened. They know it's 6 million. They know it's gas. It's not what the knowledge is missing. It's what's missing is the experience. They are not being shaken by it. They are not aware of the significance of it. It's not the facts. They know what happened. They just don't care. So what we wanted to do is to make them care. And the way to do that is to, you know, create an experience. Create 107 minutes that will stay with them, you know, hopefully to the end of their lives. And they realize that this is a human affair. This is not Jews, non-Jews, Germans. This is who we are. There are no sides here. It's a trauma and a tragedy of our civilization. What happened? It's all plural with us. There is no innocent ones. You know what I mean? We are all part of this. Something went wrong. I don't know when. That's for the philosophers to figure it out. What we wanted to show is that, as Imre Kertész said it very well, and that's what I think Hollywood is not ready to recognize. If you look at Schindler's List, for example, which is one of the more honest attempts, obviously. It starts colored, then it goes black and white, and it's again colored at the end, which suggests to you that this was an episode in human history. It was dark, it was terrible, but it's over. And Imre Kertész is saying is that we are not living after Auschwitz. We are living in the times of Auschwitz. And there is no political sign or reason for us to sigh and to say like, oh, this cannot happen. It did happen. It did happen in Europe a bit with the Bosnians. And it happened on other continents as well. And it seems like that the leadership of the world is not in capacity to stop any of this. Look at the 500,000 Syrians being murdered by their own government. And nobody is able to or capable really to move a finger about it. Everybody talks the talk, but this is a sport, a permanent possibility. It's keep happening. And this is very much connected with Auschwitz. It's different people this time. It's different way of doing it. It's different. But at the end, the cruelty is the same, and that is basically what I think Laszlo had in mind to do. We didn't want to illustrate history. We wanted to shock. That's what we wanted, to shock. We didn't want to talk about, you know, this humanistic, optimistic, Hollywoodian, Disneyfied version of you either have a survivor or you have a rescuer. No, that's not what happened. In our movie, no one is being rescued and no one survives because that was usually what happened. So why always to talk about the exception? Let's finally give voice to the voiceless, the people, you know, 2 out of 3 in the case of Europe's jury, who never made it, who never made it.
István? Oh, no, Kecske?
Yeah. It was such a beautiful question you had earlier about our boring normality, and we keep on forgetting to appreciate, and we keep on struggling of, I have to break out from my normality, I need challenges in my life to keep me going, and it was in such great context, that at one point we are reaching the moment when we need that boring normality back in our lives. We are lucky in Eastern Europe, because as Hrabal said it, I think, it's hard to get bored in Eastern Europe. So no danger on that behalf. We have to keep on wishing and dreaming about that boring normality. I would, and then making a step, another step, I would say, no secret at all, I think our movie is not a Holocaust movie at all, as strange as it sounds. I would fully agree with the plural Geza just used, that it's about us, and it's about, for me again, it's about human and all the question around it of being human and the animal and the danger within a person, within souls, and we have to nourish, we have to take care not to go on the wild side of it. We all have that fence when we go over there. And then definitely we have to search the ways to see the good part in each other, and not to chop down or to close an opportunity to have a discussion, to have an encounter, to have a meeting. We have a tree back at home. It's an apple tree, and it's my mother's favorite apple tree. It's more than 92% a dead tree, still making apples. A few. Bottle apple, just to be going till the end. And we just had the discussion with my mother but we keep on having this discussion. It's a hollow something inside the whole tree. It's quite a big one. But in its weird way, still keeps on making apples. We love the idea of having my mother's favorite apple. And of course, it endangers the road, the fence, it will destroy. And we just discussed it. Mother, it's your favorite apple, okay? So I'm not going to, you're never going to see me chopping off that tree from there. I don't care if it goes straight on the fence, destroying it. Then that's the end of that apple tree, and we'll remake the fence afterwards. So basically, I think it's not like, it's because it just happened, I'm not owning any truth or something, but I think this is the way how we should interact with each other, about not blocking, that, stamping people out, that's a crazy guy. I don't want to go into politics, but I can't, So that's what happened in the United States. When you name something a crazy bunch of people, we are not discussing because we are much more intellectual. We know much, and it's a shame for me to discuss with you. And then you see what's going on because of denial of the possibility of communicating basically to each other. It's a dead end. We are just enjoying that, so I'm trying to hold to this one and encouraging people to, okay, we all have people, you know, it's chemistry, I don't really like, maybe it's the smell, maybe it's the idea, maybe it's the whatever, but to force yourself to keep open, exactly as I would advise again, but I have no advice. I've seen good Hollywood movies. And I keep on searching for good Hollywood movies because excuse me, all the great people in this room alive now and since this building was erected, it's just a huge bunch of people doing movies over there. And from time to time, if you search enough, you find good Hollywood movie too. It is a different system, indeed. Yes, but still, they are doing movies. We are doing movies, and the good ones, if they lucky enough, then they're gonna reach the right audience, and every movie can reach his own audience and to have an impact, because basically it's entertainment. I'm sorry, I don't want to hurt anybody's feeling, but. And at the moment when you entered in a movie, and if we are talking morality, and then you go into a cinema to entertain yourself by watching a Holocaust movie, including ours. Now that's a bit tricky there for me. Okay? I'm sorry.
Concerning what Geza said before, that the film wants to make us to have an experience about a day there. I think that I found out a secret of this functioning, in this, at least for me. For me, the point is that this film is an approach to the Holocaust through an inferno rhythm. And for the viewer, it creates a resonance between the factory of death, the concentration camp, and the nowadays factory of life. I mean, our attempt to create our CVs by a terrible rhythm of work, as if we would be our Sonderkommando, in the sense that we pretend that it's normal to work in this rhythm in four copies, but we know the secret that it isn't at all. This rhythm will finish us. So, in more concrete terms, there is an Oberkapo inside me, shouting all the day, Arbeit! All week, all month. Okay, I know that the conditions are very, very different in my case and in a concentration camp. But the rhythm is similar. The rhythm can be comparable. I think that this resonance between these two rhythms helped me to enter in that experience you spoke about.
I two things. One is, in some ways, and please understand me well, the situation is even worse nowadays in the sense that this movie has a form and it has a content. Now, we spoke a little bit about the form. The other innovation of Laszlo was that this genre, the so-called Holocaust movies, has its own iconography. You know, it's we saw this. We know the shaven heads and the striped pajamas and the tattooed. There's no tattoo. There's no striped pajamas. There's no shaven heads in our movies. So just as in the sense of aesthetically, we wanted to sort of remove away from the stereotypical, you know, elements that you see in this movie. But more importantly, I think in terms of content, what we brought to the table was not popularly or widely known in the world, and this is the Sonderkommando. Now, I think we introduced this very term, Sonderkommando. People, at least in Hungary and, you know, in some circles, at least who care about movies, they know that when we talk about Nazism, then we talk about not just numbers, but we talk about an extremely demonic and smart and effective system and psychological insight. I think we wanted to show the worst aspect of this, the Nazi system. And that is why I believe, and I just, this is a, in parenthesis, I'm not sure if anybody knows, I think you do know all, but I'm not sure if the audience knows, that there is one country, just one in this world, you would be surprised, that didn't like this movie and had no positive reviews about this movie, didn't buy the movie, didn't distribute the movie, didn't talk about the movie, and tried to ignore this movie the very best they could, and that's Germany. Now, they, right now they call it the Berlinale, you know, the festival, which is presently talking is the most prestigious film festival in Europe, more prestigious than Cannes. And we, the first choice of Laszlo would have been to be selected into the program of the Berlin Film Festival. Guess what? They said, we don't want your movie. And I think the reason, and I don't want to talk about present Germany, because what do I know? I don't live there. I don't really speak the language. But I think there is a connection between this fact that I just put out there, the German rejection of Son of Saul, and the following. We brought to you, I think, which wasn't necessarily widely known, this aspect of Nazism, that they left the dirty work for the victims themselves. This, to me, is most demonic, a most demonic system, if they would have done it all. And they would have said, you Jews have nothing to do, just go and die. We'll have the manpower to take care of you. No. What happened is that all these camps, and let me just spell this out because I'm not sure if this piece of history is also well known. Right now, the Holocaust is being monopolized by Auschwitz. Everybody talks about Auschwitz, Auschwitz, Auschwitz. Auschwitz wasn't the worst place. There are three more places in Poland, not far from Auschwitz, that were way worse than Auschwitz. You know why? Belzec, Treblinka, Chmelno. These little Polish towns, no one cares about it. Most people don't even know there were camps. Now, those camps had no barracks. In other words, they had no selection. People arrived, and 100% of the people who arrived in less than 4 hours were ashes. There were no such thing as selection because you're able to work, because you look young, we can have some use of you. So Auschwitz was, I understand it was large, and in terms of as a Hungarian tragedy, I mean, 99% of Hungarian Jews who lost their lives, they died in Auschwitz. So I understand it's central for us. But what I'm about to say is that these camps were set up to answer one question. How can the most Jews be killed by the least number of Germans being involved? And why I started my answer to say to you that the situation in some regards worse now than then is that The Germans at 1944 did not have the capacities that we have now, because they didn't have the machinery. They couldn't done it with robots. But have you heard about drones? The Sonderkommando was nothing else but the human drone. You don't even need people anymore to do these things. Look at how the war is taking place, or how the U.S. is going after the bad guys. And I understand that there are bad guys out there. That's not what I'm trying to tell, that you don't need, you know, to catch the terrorist. You do need to catch the terrorist. But what I'm trying to tell is to bring your attention to the fact that you have a drone, basically a size of this table, flying in the air, make no decisions, and somewhere with a mouse very far away from this flying object, the drone, is making a decision, and a 10-story building is out. They don't even have an airplane anymore, or just someone on the fifth floor making an omelet. You just target that person and kill that person in the kitchen. These are the drones. These inanimate objects are, to me, the current version of Sonderkommando. And because you don't even need to face their feelings, drones do not revolt. You know, it's even worse nowadays. In other words, technology makes it even all the way more possible to do such things in the future.
I should agree with Geza, I should answer a question.
Okay, I will suggest now, I would suggest now to open up the floor. Yeah, do we have a moving mic, a running mic here to that one? We need a person to
help,
to have it or to offer it to somebody. Are you doing that? Gyere, légy szíves. Köszönjük, igen. Okay, thank you. There is a question right there. Yes, perfect.
I would like to ask Geza, if I'm not very intrusive, I can assume that you had some personal fears before starting the movie concerning your origins, your roots maybe. But apart from those reasons, did you have any fears, any anxieties as individual unrelated to your origin?
I don't think that the lead act in this movie had to be Jewish. It's not something that, you know, I think that, yeah, I happen to have, you know, a grandfather who was there, and but it might be initiated me, so to speak, into the narrative. But I think, you know, take for example András, our moderator, right? His family was also in Aduna Delta. I don't know how to say that in English, but also had his share or part of terribly being, you know, deported to a place where they do not had familiar roots and stayed there and all that. Thank God they made it all. But so in other words, Levente pointed out life is not boring in Eastern Europe. So many people, groups of people were discriminated and taken revenge of or whatever. This sort of experience, I don't think is inherently different. I don't think that in the 20th century the Jewish experience is something unique. I mean, in terms of size, yes, but being uprooted by a political power and having your father, grandparents disappearing and never hear them back again, this is unfortunately all too familiar, if not universal.
Okay. Next question, please. If there is no question, or you are just preparing yourself, I know, Kachka, that you are casted in the next movie of Nemes Laszlo also. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I can't talk about it.
You can't talk about it?
I don't know. You might know more than me. Sem megerősíteni, sem...
Cáfolni
nem szabad nekem.
Okay, fine. Let's try to put a question they might be able to answer, to talk about.
Let me just say one more thing, and if you have any questions, you can maybe put it together while I speak. Back to you, Michaela. I think you said it so well, that, and it was one of our concerns too, we didn't want Saul to become a hero. So I can proudly say that after many conversations and even fights, I did end up to have one of my own sentences in this movie. And I'm not sure if you remember, but some of you may remember. There's one point when Saul says, actually to you, in this movie, that the boy is not from my wife.
Correct.
Right. Now, so I insisted to that line. Because I didn't want Saul, even by any chance, someone to think that Saul is some sort of a hero, a saint, a some sort of a pure guy. No, he did cheat on his wife, and he is like regular person, having challenges and falls like we all do in our daily lives. And I wanted to put that in because, you know, we didn't want to create give any chance to people. Right. So I just wanted to point that out.
Geza, you just, and we all know that you are not a professional actor. What do you consider about this role or about this experience? Is that a unique one for you, or you are open to take a new role, a new challenge, to read a new script, and to go further in this business?
No. But for now, I'm not a dogmatic person in any way. I actually also love what Levente had to say about that moving pictures, films do have to do something with entertainment, more than literature or other ways
okay,
of art.
Okay, I don't agree with this regarding this movie.
No.
This movie breaks the rules of the entertainment.
That's true.
Absolutely.
No, I agree with that. But what I'm trying to say is that, and I also always say this because I think it's very important to say that it's a very tricky thing when it comes to national traumas, and all countries have their own national traumas, because on the one hand you owe to the victims to make sure you remember them and you never forget them, and on the other hand, things like the Holocaust, you do not want ever to be paralyzed by it. You do not want your capacity of joy to be taken away from you, because that's not what the victims would you want to do. Right? They don't want you to have an identity or a worldview that is being totally catastrophized by this one event. And I'm not saying that this is absolutely substantial, important. It tells a lot about our age, and we have to keep it on mind and all that. At the same time, I was offered roles, and I love humor. I love the smaller things. Holocaust is as big as it gets. It's huge. And if I would make ever a movie, or would love to read a script, would about like in a Wednesday, and not on a vacation, nothing special, just something that it's about the small detailed, the fabric of our lives, the boring normalcy. So that's the sort of, I'm not against acting in movies, whatever. But what I'm not willing to do is to take the blessing that I could be in Son of Saul and use it to be in a 10-minute part in Spider-Man, which I was offered. I don't want to do that. It would pay much more than Son of Saul, but I feel in some ways that the dignity of Saul, so to speak, I don't want to give my face for silliness and stupidity after. I feel like I have to preserve Saul this moment. I think it brought lots of happiness for example the Hungarian audience in a sense of the Oscars. I'm not talking about, you know, if this this is another thing I would like to mention, because you guys have no questions, is two things. One, which is really important, that if our movie would have been an American movie, it never gets an Oscars. Never in ever. Because you need stars in American movies. The only category this movie could win an Oscar was in the foreign language category. So that tells a lot about what's wrong with Hollywood. You understand? The star system, the celebrity and all that. So that's number one. And number two is that what's sort of so beautiful and unpredictable about our movie is that it never was meant to get into the mainstream. You know, I'm sure Laszlo hoped for a couple of awards on some European festivals, but to go to this high, this wasn't at all imagined or intended or whatever. We made no compromise towards that. And to be completely honest, if this movie does not win the Oscars, certainly much less people see it, much less Hungarians see it. But that doesn't take away from the pleasure of that national pride the morning after the Oscars, that people who might politically or whatever, you know, were sort of cynical, whatever, but once we got it, that day was just so worth it. It was just so beautiful. And I think there are moments in this life, those days fade and they don't stay with us very long. But there are some times what you were talking about, the apple tree and the looking, sort of unity, to experience the unity from one man to the next. Very rare occasion. I felt it personally in September 12th in New York City, when people, just no one went to work, and people were hanging out late night on the street, and there was no nationality, no ethnicity, nothing. It was just New Yorkers. And they were talking and like, what should we do? Money? What should I give? Blood? Should I do war? Where? How? There was this unity. It was gone probably a week after, but there was such unity. And in a small level, something similar I felt, you know, when we went all the way and this tiny country was able to get that high, with a very shameful moment of the Hungarian history. So it was all mixed, but it was very beautiful at the same time.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, please?
I have a question, and it's in reference to you saying that the movie isn't about the Holocaust. It's more about like someone finding some sense of humanity in something when they're essentially dead inside. So do you think that a movie like this could be made without the Holocaust, or do you think it's the Holocaust that really brings out that same intensity in it, that same feeling?
But since it was me saying this about it's not a Holocaust movie, you know, it's hard to find stories that were not written by the ancient Greeks. And dramaturgy is such a beautiful art that you can hide the same story inside infinite number of movies. If you are approaching our project, our movie, from this point of view, then actually it's just another skeleton with a different type of flesh and muscles on it. Yes? And if I know it's, I can hear myself, it's a bit cruel what I'm saying, but I'm again approaching from the movie part of it, from making a movie, and not from the topic. And then I'll reach your idea about changing the topic, basically, the story of it. So if you had this skeleton, have a good skeleton, which is a dramaturgy. And then if you find that idea around which idea, you can actually imagine a world. If you succeed to have that question formed in a way that it can resonate with, in our case, not just with Jews, not just with Hungarians, not just with Romanians, Eastern Europeans, Europeans, Americans. So it's kind of, and that's the humanity I'm talking, because we deny it or we accept it. We do resonate on the same buttons, you know? And yes, I think you can do the same movie with Khmer Rouge. I think you can do the movie about, I don't want to go into some fields I have no expertise at all. I'm struggling with this art thingy too. But I think yes, you can, there was a Soviet Union killing 60 million, you know? There was a beautiful regime over here, creating memories even for Andras too. Eastern Europe with all this juggling the borders and not loving your neighbor type of environment, you know? But you, and of course, our movie is about Holocaust. The guy guilty for this, and even for the success of this project, and guilty in commas, yes, it's László Nemes, the director, who managed to build up the story, the people around him, the, find the topic, being able to go and follow his ideas, as stubborn as possible. Because as Geza said, and I'm not, again, if I'm taking it from this point of view, I have no problems that Berlin Film Festival said no. And basically they said it was not a no, because they just put it in a panorama section. And then it was again László's decision saying that he'll recall it from there. You know, just a second. And, you know, and I don't want to, again, go find some similarity in between the Nazi Germany and this Germany, reunified Germany, saying that it's a kind of Nazi gift that they don't want to distribute our movies. I don't want to pretend that there are no neo-Nazis in Germany right now, okay? I'm quite sure they are. But again, communicating, it is the issue all the time. And yes, on this behalf, this, and in Hungarian history, by the way, or filmography, not to mention Transylvanian thingy, the topic of Holocaust was not really discussed at all. So that's a good point again to get the chance and communicate. You know, and our movie puts specific group of people in focus. Sonderkommandos. Geza was saying that, yes, we entered it in the mainstream, a topic. But basically, again, this technique, it was not invented by the Germans, of putting your own people to... the Turks were doing it. Kind of everybody's doing it. You know, taking people, twisting them and sending them against their own people. And usually they are much more cruel than the so-called, is there an expression? Normal enemy. I don't think that, you know, but, so I think yes, But again, please don't forget, my point of view is from creating an artwork. Okay? That can resonate with people. And I don't want to get into history.
Three things. First, just to factually, you know, to say how it was, the Berlinale said no. No panorama section, nothing. And these film festivals are spying each other. And once the Berlin Festival learned that the movie was accepted to Cannes, but it wasn't announced yet, they reapproached again, saying it's not going to be in a section, it can ever have an award, but we are ready to show it in a panorama section. So first they said no, then they kind of sneaked back to say, we are ready to show, but no award, in any chance, but you got media, but you get no award. And so that's that. I also wanted to tell this lady that one thing I felt like I didn't address your question in fully, because you asked me about my own and all that, and I think it goes back to your question in the back about. So I think, and we didn't talk about this, and I don't think we will, because I think the time is over. But what makes, I guess, this tragedy maybe somewhat different from other tragedies is this whole idea of the covenant between, at least how the Jewish people hold it between them and God. Now, this whole, of course, all nations believe some way or another in the creator of the world. And this is when if someone ends up like Levente was referring to, one of those 60 millions and ends up in the gulag, right? That person also is questioning about God's participation in this story and the idea of justice and how is this going to the answer of prayers. And it's very challenging on a level of faith and a level of theology, all what happened. And I'm not going to get into that, maybe just one line. There is this Lutheran professor who was sort of, you know, confronted by a non-believer, an atheist fellow, and say, well, wasn't God weak during the time of Auschwitz? And he said, yes, God was weak during the time of Auschwitz because he had no friends. In other words, let's just not put the blame on God only. God has a part of the blame, make no mistake. But you can't say that it was him. It was him and us, and since we are us, we have to take ownership of our part of the responsibility. And finally, back to the gulags. I think, and we might maybe a tiny bit, whatever, disagree on this. So Solzhenitsyn, you know, wrote a lot very well, and Primo Levi pointed to this, because there are these huge numbers of victims on every side, Khmer Rouge, and you can go on Rwanda and Sudan, and you name it. Primo Levi said, I think it's an important distinction. If you read Solzhenitsyn, time by time, it comes back that someone in a gulag turns to the officer, to the guards, and says to them, you are not a true communist. No one ever said that to a Nazi. And that is the difference between the crimes of Nazism and communism. It's not the number. The number are even higher with the communists. But there is something about the blatant, naked violence. You know, the communists did corrupt themselves to the same result. But even in the gulag, people said, you are not a true communist. You might have a red star on your uniform, but you are not a true communist. It wasn't even possible ever to say that to an SS. And that's where I see the differences. There are similarities as well, make no mistake, but there are differences as well.
The last question, please. Just a second.
Thank you. I would like to ask you about the afterlife of the movie, about how was the experience for you to meet the audience, and were there any revelating dialogues or questions or anything like this for you?
Thank you. That's that's a good one to finish with. No, because it sort of points to the future. So there are few people stand out. I mean, just like Levent went to places, I also went to places from jails all the way to church groups and high schools especially. I think right now, if you look at anti-Semitism in the world, it's mostly under 40. It's youth. It's not. You don't find really older people, 60 plus, who are having this sort of racist, crazy prejudices. But if you go in mostly, at least in the West and America, this is politically on the left and the youth. And so it's extremely important for me, if I have to make the sad choice of going either to an old age home or a high school, then I'm going to go to a high school, because these people will grow up and they will do things in the future, so they have more power, sort of to shape history. And I would say that, for example, I had the chance to speak with the president of European Union, Martin Schulz, who might be the next chancellor, how do you say, chancellor after Merkel. Might be, I don't think so he will, but he's running. And what we concluded to is that, you know, Germany does everything right. You know, he brings the people to the camp of Auschwitz, and the kids are chewing gum, and the kids are making selfies, and the kids are not, it doesn't work like it used to. And he told me, and others told me as well, that our movie, besides being cheaper, does a better job to reach the core of a human being, German or not, anybody, than actually visit the camp. Because it became a tourist attraction. And it's sort of, there's so many things to distort the experience. It's not what it used to be. When I went to the camp in 1987 first, still behind the Iron Curtain, it was a December day. It was 50 of us. There was no buses. There were no Coca-Cola automats. There was no cafeteria, nothing. It was the real place. Now it's different. It's like feeling you are in the Louvre and you wanted to see the Mona Lisa, and they're pushing you from the back, and you can't even stand in front of Mona Lisa. You have to go, because the next guy is behind you. So that's an issue of educating and sensitizing people about what we are capable of. And I think our movie right now does the trick. It probably does it for 5 or 10 years, and then a new movie has to be done about the Gulag, about the Khmer Rouge, about the Holocaust, whatever it is. But we have to be aware of how fast things can go wrong.
Two encounters that marked me. One was in Yash. Yash has, as Cluj has, his own history with Holocaust. Romania has his own history with Holocaust. Quite interesting, by the way. We just ended the year when Romania was in charge of the Holocaust remembering committee of something, and we just ended that period. The events in Transnistria and, well, from the both sides that we were sending people, but somehow it's a gray zone that nobody recognizes. Because it was Romania, well, now it's Romania, then it's not Romania. Interesting attitude. And then it was, in the line of events that happened in Yash has a specific cruelty. Again, they were at least as fast as Hungarian authorities involving citizens in these cruel events. So it's a gray zone, and it was interesting to kind of meet the deafness of today. You know, because I got invited over there. We were after the fireworks, and they basically they wanted to celebrate the. Thanks God, our success. Nothing wrong in that one. But indeed, I think this movie, the most what can give to us is to open an opportunity. Or for at least one discussion. Not, you don't have to find the truth. You don't have to judge. You don't have to agree. You don't have to. You just have to be part of that discussion. And it was so weird that people actually watched the movie. And afterwards, it was just like, okay, we had this ice cream and we have, it's an Italian ice cream or Hungarian ice cream, and then we, let's go on and strangely enough, and what I appreciate the most is that I was a party ruiner, I have to admit, because after then I provoked a debate about it, and then the openness of the people over there was again as much astonishing as the kind of, I named it, deafness, you know, because yet, and to meet people over there, old people, young people, middle-aged people, that of course there were some knowing all the story about it. And of course there were young people not being aware what just happened around the corner from that building. And experiencing that shock live there when a person discovers something that was kind of, I don't even know if it was hidden. Because if you hide something, then it means that you are preoccupied by it. It was just, I think it's even more painful. It was just forgotten. And that was one encounter, one of the interesting encounters over there. And then the second one to close it, and it's good for finish, this one too. It was, we together got the chance to meet the last survivings on the commando, a gentleman that you would expect, he had his age.
94.
He had his issues, age related. And you were you would expect to find the guy that is depressed, that is, has no joy of life at all, and then to fill you up with stories of Holocaust. And what you got, my stupidity, that's what I'm talking about. And what you got is joy of life, enjoying every breath of it, and managing to irradiate others with this after going through the valley of death. These are my two encounters.
Okay, thank you very much. We are also the afterlife of the movie, I think, all of us. Thank you, Levente Molnár, Géza Rőrik, for participating. Thank you, Mihaela, for accepting the invitation, and István for organizing the event. Okay, thank you for the Hungarian Academic Institute in Cluj for supporting financially the event. Thank you, Anna Sós, for hosting practically this evening. Thank you all. Good night for everybody. Thank you very much.